Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, we begin today's show by going to Kabul to learn more about the negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban. We will also talk about ongoing deadly attacks on the civilian population. This year alone, nearly 300,000 Afghans have been internally displaced. Joining us is Ali Latifi, a freelance reporter based in Kabul, Afghanistan. Hi, Ali. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Ali. Before we talk about what's going on between the Taliban and the government, let's talk about COVID for a few minutes. Can you give us an update on the coronavirus pandemic in Afghanistan? As of December 3rd, just yesterday, according to the Ministry of Public Health, over 47,000 people have had COVID and 1,841 people have died.
So it's quite interesting because I'm actually working on a story about this right now. And since I want to say like June, life has very much gone back to normal in Afghanistan. You know, restaurants are open, schools reopened, universities reopened. Some of them have closed again, but you know, there are weddings where like 1,000, 2,000 people sit in one hall. And, you know, life has really, really gone back to normal. And, you know, I was asking a lot of people, why is that? That in Afghanistan, all of a sudden, you know, if you compare it to, from what I understand, like what life is like in the United States or the UK right now, it's very, very different. You know, people sit on buses here. Like, as I said, restaurants are fully open. It's not like, you know, you were hearing stories in other places where like there were mannequins to separate people or tables were spaced up. It's everything's gone back completely to normal. Now, the thing about that figure that the Ministry of Public Health pointed out is that it's 46,000, 47,000, but that's only the actual registered cases. So it's only people who went to the hospital and who were able to be diagnosed with COVID. Because a lot of people either didn't have access to the hospital or they were afraid to go to the hospital because, A, just in general, hospitals here aren't very clean and efficient and hygienic. And also, you know, they would have been overcrowded. They didn't know if they would have actually been put in separate rooms. So a lot of people just quarantined themselves in their own homes. So the figure is relatively low compared to the rest of the world, but that's because testing has been, until recently, so limited, and so few people actually went or were able to go to the hospital to get tested. And so when I was asking people, you know, why do you think that life in Afghanistan went back to normal so quickly, they gave a few reasons. One was obviously economy. You know, Afghanistan doesn't have the social services. It doesn't even have the proper bureaucracy to know who's unemployed and how to reach them and to give them proper assistance. So people, especially daily wage workers, were forced to go back to work. Some of them even amid the lockdown, you know, like shoe cobblers or like people who sell food and fruits and vegetables and stuff on the street sides. They went back to, or money exchangers, things like that. Like they went back to work right away. They were out on the streets even during the lockdown. The other thing was just sort of the fact that for people who had a little bit more money in, like, for instance, in a city like Kabul, there's very few recreational options. You know, like you either basically go to a restaurant or a cafe or you go shopping. That's really all there is. So people were, you know, being pent up in the house where there isn't 24-hour electricity or proper high-speed internet, it can really weigh down on you. So people were in a rush to get back to, you know, what sorts of simple recreational options they had. And then the other thing was that someone else pointed out is that so there was a good like two and a half month period where every household you talk to, you know, if not the entire household, several people within that household got it. And they all self-medicated. They all self-treated at home. They self-quarantined. they stayed inside. And so now the thinking has sort of become everyone who got it, and those who survived, survived, and those who didn't, unfortunately, didn't. And so it's sort of this idea of, I guess, like herd immunity. I think that's sort of like those sorts of things are leading people to go back to life as normal, which is, from my understanding, is very different from how the rest of the world is in terms of COVID right now.
Are people wearing masks, Ali? And are masks and basic protections available?
They're available. They're available. People, I'd say probably like 10-20% of the people are wearing them. And there was a time like earlier, like around like March, April, May, when, you know, hand sanitizer prices skyrocketed, even the price of lemons because they have vitamin C. Even to this day, before you make a phone call, like while it's ringing, every cell phone provider has this long message and it actually tells you to take things with vitamin C, and the prices of lemons, oranges, things like that really skyrocketed. In the beginning, even basic goods like flour, wheat, other basic essentials were going up too. But yeah, now you can find everything and the prices have returned back to normal. But it's just not as prevalent as it was before. As I said, now, you know, in a group of 10 people, you might see one or two people wearing a mask.
What about, how have people been affected when it comes to the economy, given that so many Afghans have been struggling? In 2012, 37% of Afghans were listed below the poverty rate, surviving on less than a dollar a day. And today that figure has risen to 55%.
Right. So that's exactly the issue. And that's exactly why, as I said earlier, so many people were eager, as I said, like people who, you know, like daily wage workers, like, let's say, like house painters or carpenters or money exchangers and shoe cobblers and people who sell like food and fruits and vegetables and stuff, things like that on the streets. They were back on the streets within the first few days of the lockdown because, as I said, they said themselves, we can't afford not to go out and work. The government did try, like, for instance, like a bread distribution and things like that, but it wasn't effective and it wasn't able to reach who it needed to. And I think that's a big part of why, you know, things had to go back to normal so quickly. You know, like restaurants had to reopen, schools had to reopen. You know, for instance, with schools, you know, like some of them went online, like the private schools went online, but if you don't have 24-hour electricity, it doesn't do you much good, you know?
Right. Well, and overall, Ali, I mean, because of the election, we haven't spent as much time as we'd like to on international issues. And as you know, unfortunately, really, the only time that Afghanistan gets attention in the U.S. media is when violence happens or when there's like a one-off story about, you know, women doing amazing things, which is great to read. I do love those stories, but we're not getting much context. We're not really learning much about what's happening on the ground on a regular basis, unless we really look for it. So can you just give us a sense overall about, you know, just really how things are going overall on the ground?
Bad.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, there are definitely, you know, there was a while right after the Taliban signed their agreement with Washington in February where they sort of stuck to the agreement where they said they wouldn't attack major cities, where, you know, the number of attacks seemed to get lower. But over the last, I want to say, 4 or 5 months, that number has completely skyrocketed now, you know. There's always reports almost every day of at least one IED attack or car bomb or targeted killing. We've had journalists be killed in targeted killings. We've had government workers. We've had security forces. And in all of this, civilians will always get caught up in those attacks. They will always fall victim to those attacks. And If I remember, I believe it was today that the Taliban spokesman said that now that an agreement has been settled in terms of actually starting the talks between the government and the Taliban, he said something to the effect of, and we will be addressing the ceasefire, which the government insists on. And I took issue with the way he worded that, because the thing is, that's not something the government insists on alone. Everybody in this country is insisting on that ceasefire. I was just in the province of Herat, on the western side of Afghanistan, near the Iranian border a couple weeks ago. And the sense of insecurity and uncertainty there, it was absolutely shocking to me. Because of COVID, I wasn't able to go over the last year. So the last time I was there, you know, there were districts that I was able to go to a year or two ago that are only about 40 minutes away from the city that I wasn't able to go to this time. There were districts that I remember when I went to, they're like, yeah, it's perfectly safe. There's no issues. You have nothing to worry about. And now we couldn't even go there. So insecurity has really, really become an issue. Now that you have the prevalence of IEDs and these targeted killings, it really makes people feel even less secure than they did, you know, say even a year ago. It was only about a week or two ago where the city of Kabul, there was something like 26 rockets fired into the city early in the morning. I woke up to the sound of the rocket fire. Mm. So it's really, really gotten bad. And this is why it's so important that something actually comes of these peace talks finally.
What explains this violence, Ali? And as a reporter, are you able, you know, how do you find out who's behind it? And, you know, what is the explanation for it?
It's very difficult to know who's behind it. You know, it's very, because, you know, like certain things will get blamed on the so-called Islamic State. Certain things the Taliban will say we didn't do, but then the government will say they did it. It's very difficult to know exactly who's, there's always assumptions, and the government always tends to want to say everything is the Taliban, which it very well could be. But I think that the biggest issue right now for people is, it is important who does it, but more important than that is, why isn't it being controlled? You know, why are these things still happening? Okay, if IEDs exist in the city of Kabul, well, they must be distributed somewhere in the city. They must be sold in the city. Why aren't those being shut down quickly enough? Like, why aren't they being found out and being shut down? Or how does someone, you know, there's video of the alleged attacker who launched the rockets in the middle of the city of Kabul on a little cart, you know, it was something like 26 rockets. You know, how did this person get into the city with 20 something rockets, passing through all these gates and all these checkpoints? And how was he able to fire them all off one after another in, you know, a very well trafficked area of the city without anyone being able to stop him? So it's really upsetting to people on both sides. On the one hand, it's that the Taliban is not living up to their side of the agreement. And on the other hand, why isn't enough being done to try and make the security situation better, to make these ministers and these officials take responsibility for the security situation?
A number of journalists have said that they do not feel safe and that they are actually leaving. What are your thoughts on this, Ali? I mean, how are you protecting yourself?
I'm very privileged. I have the protection of, you know, as long as there are flights, as long as I have money, I can leave. Hmm. But beyond that, there's really not much that you can do, because, I mean, that's like the day of the rocket attack. I had to meet some friends later in the day, and I kept thinking, like, what if they come back, you know? And there's nothing you can do about that. Or with these IEDs and these sticky bombs attached to cars, you really don't know. For instance, when I was in Herat, I was with a government official, with the former governor of that province, and every now and then we would go with him to places, and I always wanted to tell the drivers, like, keep a distance, because if he gets targeted, then we'll get the blowback too. You know, I mean, that may sound crass, but it's, and I actually avoided going places with him because of that. I prefer to just go in a taxi or in a rickshaw and like take my chances that way. But it's really, that's the difficulty of it is now it's suicide bombings, it's rockets, it's IEDs, it's magnetic bombs. These are things that you can't run away from, you know, and that you can't. I mean, what do? Lock yourself? You could lock yourself in the house, but a rocket could fall on your house, you know. So it's this really that's what I'm saying. That's what makes it so much more difficult for people, is there's really no circumstance or time when people actually feel safe and secure.
Today we are speaking with Ali Latifi, a freelance reporter based in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ali will be with us for about 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions for him about what is happening on the ground in Afghanistan, this is getting a lot of attention in the United States. And we'll ask Ali about this deal between the Taliban and the government. And then the Trump administration saying that they're going to remove 2,000 troops from Afghanistan. It's getting a lot of coverage here. So what are your thoughts about that? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Ali, before we talk about all of those important issues, I just want to make sure we don't end the show or end our segment with you without talking about what you hear from Afghans on the ground when you're doing your reporting. I mean, I'm sure there's a wide range of opinion. What really stands out for you?
In terms of what?
In terms of what they want. I mean, as you said, people are so tired.
That's all anybody wants. All anybody wants is an end to this fighting.
And how do you get there?
That's not up to the people, unfortunately. Look, this deal, this original deal was made between the Taliban and the United States, and it was signed in Doha. It was signed in Qatar, in a foreign country. And just now, slowly, the government is starting to be involved. I mean, the sort of what's taken so long in terms of actually starting the talks between the government and the Taliban, it's very minute. It's down to the verbiage, you know. For instance, the government insisted that they be called the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. The Taliban wanted to be called the Islamic Emirate, the Islamic Emirates of Afghanistan. You know, it's come down to these very fine logistical points, these points of verbiage that are slowing everything. And they're obviously they're symbolic. They mean a lot. But to the people, the thing that means the most is the ceasefire. Because people want to, as I said, like, you know, if you have rockets and you have suicide bombs and you have IEDs and you have magnetic bombs and you have all of these things, there's really no time when you feel safe. And it's gotten so much worse now that, you know, people just really, really need the ceasefire. That's what they care the most about, is an end to the fighting.
So give us a sense of, you know, what is happening with these talks. And can you first tell us, in terms of the Afghan government, you retweeted a tweet from Transparency International, and there was an anti-corruption winner. If you can tell us more about this newspaper, they won an award for their efforts exposing corruption scandals in Afghanistan.
So it's the Daily Etalat-e Roz, which means like the daily information, the information of the day. And it's a really small operation. It's independently funded. It's independently run. The founder, Zaki Daryabi, he's worked really hard to bring this paper up to, and it's really risen to prominence. It's beat even like the more famous papers in the country in terms of its coverage. And, you know, exposing that corruption, it's a big risk, because the thing is, in this country, you know, bullets are very cheap, bombs are very cheap, IEDs are very cheap, and there are so many attacks on journalists and other people that we never find out who is responsible for it, you know? And we have so many strong men in this country, so many warlords in this country, so many people with so many guns. So for them to take this on, it actually is a huge risk. It's really putting themselves very literally in the line of fire. So it's a big deal that it's gotten this amount of international recognition, and B, that it's done such amazing reporting, given all of, you know, even the basic constraints of staffing and funding, and just running a newspaper. And it still managed to succeed. So it's really, I said something like, this is an example of what the Avalon people can do, of what they're capable of. Mm. Because despite all of the odds, you know, this paper has risen not only to national prominence, but now also international.
What happens as a result of these investigations?
There's always promises.
Right. So that's how the government responds.
Investigations of the investigation. But you never, I mean, so like, for instance, when we talk about investigations, right, like, for instance, like when an attack happens, there's always promises of an investigation, but that's never made public. If that investigation actually goes through, it's never made public. For instance, a famous television journalist, he had just come back to the country after studying abroad, and he left TV to come and work in the central bank here. He was killed, it was 2-3 weeks ago now. And every day his father is calling out online on Twitter, asking, who are my son's killers? Who are my son's killers? There have been protests outside the central bank, you know, saying, where's the investigation? We still don't know who killed him. You know, and this is a young, promising, he was on, if I remember correctly, the 6 o'clock news. He was extremely famous, extremely well known. You know, everyone grew a sense of attachment and a bond to him. And when he was killed, it was a big blow, because it's someone you see in your living room every day, you know? Hmm. And we still don't know who killed him.
Then you also have to deal with the corruption of NGOs, military contractors. Exactly. The list is very long.
I mean, we just had the reports on what the Australian Special Forces did here, you know?
Right.
And it's interesting, because I called an official from one of the security bodies here, and I asked him, he couldn't give me a proper answer. I didn't even quote him, because it didn't make any sense, and I didn't want to embarrass the guy. But it was quite frustrating, because I was like, what do you want from the Australians? What are the Australians supposed to do? What can they do? What can you request from them? He couldn't answer any of those questions.
So for some context, Ali, this follows a report that came out of the United States in December. The Washington Post had this huge report, The Afghan Papers, A Secret History of War, At War with the Truth. It was about U.S. officials constantly lying about making progress. And it uncovered some very ugly, racist comments from U.S. officials. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what this report that came out of Australia revealed?
Oh, it was awful. It was to the point where, so I guess like the Australian Special Forces had this policy of, they called it blooding, if I remember correctly. And it was basically to get their first kill, quote unquote, they would kill a prisoner. Mm. They would just take a gun and kill a prisoner. And then I was talking to people who their village had been basically raided by these Australian Special Forces. You know, they said they came down from their helicopter, they came with their dogs, and, you know, they went through the market, and they went, you know, marauding into people's houses with their, like, their dogs were, like, biting people and abusing them and attacking them, and the soldiers themselves were just shooting people point blank. It's really, really, there was also, if it was a picture or a video, I don't remember, of an Australian soldier drinking out of, like, the prosthetic of, like, an alleged Talib that they killed. Like, it's really just horrible, brutal things. You know, as I taking pride in killing people. As I said, like, to get the first kill, you kill a prisoner. It was really, really quite bad. And what upset people was that they felt like the government here didn't take a strong enough stand. They just acknowledged that the report came out, but they didn't. I mean, it's kind of hard because, you know, the Australian forces are so minimal here now that it's hard to hold them accountable now here. But they just felt like, you know, even the term the government used, misconduct, you know, these are people who were sicking dogs on your people. These were people who were, you know, taking pride in killing your people openly, using it as a game, using derogatory terms towards them. So it was just another example of just how bad this war is.
And you can read a piece that Ali wrote for Al Jazeera about this called Afghans Recall Days When Australians Unleashed Dogs and Gunfire. And you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Ali, we're going to have to do a longer show about this. But before we let you go, what do you make of the media coverage of the Trump administration possibly planning to remove about 2,000 troops from Afghanistan?
You know, it's like media coverage of anything having to do with Trump. It's much more about Trump than it is about the situation here. You know, it's another way to, because what we have to remember is that Biden himself is not in favor of this war either. He wants out of this war. And, you know, the thing that when I've been talking to Afghan government officials, what they've been saying is like, look, decide if you're going to stay or you're going to go and let us know so that we can go on with our lives and with our plans, you know, because now the Afghan government is caught in this weird sort of limbo themselves because they don't know how much they can rely on the United States in terms of military support. So what the government wants is just the definitive answer. Just tell us yes or no, and then we'll deal with the rest.
And Ali, before we let you go, we have an email from Susan who says that she's concerned about your safety. Is your safety jeopardized when you go on this radio show and other programs?
No, I don't think so.
Well, Ali, you do amazing work, and we appreciate you. We'd love to have you back for the full hour to go more in depth on these issues. Sure. Thank you so much.
Anytime. All right, thank you.
Stay safe, Ali. Thank you. Ali Latifi is a freelance reporter based in Kabul, Afghanistan, and I hope you can take some time to read his recent reporting and be sure to follow him on Twitter, where he posts fairly regularly about what's going on the ground. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a short break, we will talk about changes that the Trump administration is, they're basically changes they're trying to push through before they leave office. These changes would affect people with disabilities, farm workers, people who work in meatpacking plants, and so many others. What can the Biden administration do to stop these changes? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about a very important ProPublica piece about midnight regulations. The Trump administration is rushing to implement dozens of policy changes in its final days, and ProPublica is following some of the most consequential and really controversial. I have to say that some of these changes are just really difficult to read. I mean, they're affecting everyone from people with disabilities, farm workers, people who work in meatpacking plants. They also want to bring back firing squads and executions. So I'm just going to read. We're trying to connect with our guest, Isaac Arnsdorf. And while we do that, I am going to read from this piece. So these are the rules that have been finalized. The Social Security Administration changed the criteria for disability benefits for musculoskeletal disorders like spine injuries or amputations. Disability advocates say that this rule will make it more difficult for people to qualify. And again, this is the one that has been finalized. There's another one, narrowing consumer protections for airlines. This rule will raise the bar for regulators to challenge unfair and deceptive business practices and give companies a bigger chance to fight back at formal hearings. This one has been finalized. And then another one that just really... it just makes you just kind of say, is this really happening? This rule would broaden the acceptable form of federal capital punishment to include methods that are or may soon be legal in various states, such as firing squads. The administration has restarted federal executions, which Joe Biden has said he will not allow. And joining us to talk about this is Isaac Arnsdorf, a reporter at ProPublica. Hi, Isaac. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Do we have Isaac?
Yes, can you hear me?
Hi, thank you for joining us, Isaac. When we were connecting with you, I was reading some of these rules, and I got to say, I'm kind of shocked by that law. I mean, a lot of things have been shocking over the past 4 years, Isaac, but the fact that the administration is trying to implement some of these cruel rules. For example, changing criteria for disability benefits. Can you just tell us more about this? And according to your reporting, this rule has been finalized.
Yeah, a lot of these are things that have been in the works for a long time. I mean, it typically takes a number of years to get a regulation finished from start to finalization. And so these are things that the administration has been working on and is, you know, sort of wrapping up before the deadline. And there are a number of others, however, that we're seeing that are really taking shortcuts and going through the process much, much faster with the clear goal of being finished and taking effect before President-elect Biden takes office. Now, whether those are all going to make it across the finish line remains to be seen. And the other risk that that introduces when they're rushed that way is it, you know, a sloppy, rushed regulation might have some errors in it that make it more vulnerable to being struck down in court.
So let's go over some of these because, Isaac, so much of this is just not getting much attention. I did hear a piece on NPR this morning about the airline change, but let's go over the rules that have been finalized. Can you tell us more about this rule that would affect disability benefits?
Sure. Well, this has to do with how the Social Security Administration evaluates the criteria for qualifying for benefits for musculoskeletal disorders, which it could be something more minor like carpal tunnel or something as serious as a spinal injury or an amputation. And advocates say that the result of this is it's going to take people longer to qualify or make it so that it's harder for them to qualify at all.
What could the Biden administration do to reverse this?
So now that this rule has been finalized, and for all the ones that have been finalized, it's going to be really hard. So either they're going to have to start that whole long rulemaking process from the beginning, which could take multiple years and just a lot of time and energy that the agency is spending on this instead of something else that, you know, would be like a proactive part of the new administration's agenda. So that would be one thing. The other possibility is, like I mentioned, a court challenge, and we certainly expect a lot of these to result in litigation and a lot of, even before this lame duck period, a lot of Trump administration rules have had trouble holding up in court. And then the final possibility is something called the Congressional Review Act, which is a fast-track mechanism where a simple majority in both houses of Congress can repeal a recent rule. And in 2017, congressional Republicans used this more than a dozen times to strike down midnight regulations from the end of the Obama administration. But whether that's going to be an option for Democrats this time around to block some of these last-minute Trump rules is probably going to depend on who controls the Senate based on the outcome of the two Georgia runoffs.
Where did this one come from? I mean, who was pushing for this?
Which one is that?
The disability change. Do you know who was pushing for this?
I would have to look back to the beginning of the record, but I would have to go back and look at that.
Okay. Because, you know, with so many of these other changes, it comes directly from industry, from, you know, the meatpacking billion-dollar industry. You can draw a connect line, and I'm just wondering, who would fight to ensure that people with disabilities do not get their benefits? So we're definitely going to have to do a show about this. Let's talk about a couple others. We've done shows in the past about truck drivers and just what a difficult job this is. You report that in 2019, the trucking industry in Washington state asked federal regulators to preempt a new state law requiring a higher number of meal and rest breaks than mandated under nationwide standards. On November 17th, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration granted that petition. Can you just tell us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great example of something that's kind of a direct industry wish list. A particular industry interest that wants something, and the administration you know, kind of bending over backwards to make it happen. And again, this is something that has definitely been consistent across across the all 4 years of the Trump administration, and it's just kind of happening on a more compressed timeline now.
Another one would allow the Forest Service to skip environmental rules and reviews. The administration says it's making it easier to maintain roads, trails, and campgrounds. Opponents say the rule clears the way for officials to allow logging and new roads without studying the environmental harm and seeking public input. And again, this one has been finalized.
Yes, that's right. And this is a great example of a lot of these have to do with environmental protections and different things that a number of agencies are doing to weaken or reduce those in favor of either industrial interests or just more development or kind of just less bureaucracy and permitting it and red tape.
Lowering wages for immigrant farm workers. This got a bit of attention, but it was really in the middle of all of the election news. So in many ways, it got buried. You report, you and your colleagues, this regulation changes the scale used to determine how much employers must pay immigrant farm workers on temporary H-2A work visas, freezing it for 2 years. Farm worker organizations say that this will lower the pay for U.S.-born and immigrant workers, even as there's a worker shortage in the midst of COVID. And, you know, Isaac, we've done so many shows about low pay already for immigrant farm workers. So how much lower can it come down?
Well, I think this one is interesting to contrast with at the same time that they're pushing down wages for migrant farm workers, they're also trying to make it more expensive to hire high-skill immigrants in knowledge industries like technology. So it's kind of an interesting contrast there with how they're treating two different kinds of visas depending on the skill level. And, you know, obviously immigration has been a long-standing policy priority for this president, and a lot of what's happening now are kind of formalizing policies that the Trump administration has been observing, but by turning them into a formal regulation, it'll make it harder for the Biden administration to change it without a lot more paperwork.
Mm. And then one other rule that has been finalized. Can you tell us where this one came from? The rule would broaden the acceptable forms of federal capital punishment to include methods that are or may soon be legal in various states, such as firing squads and electrocution.
Well, this one is the Justice Department restarted federal executions for this year for the first time since 2003, and a number of procedural and legal issues were raised in the course of litigation, you know, challenges by lawyers trying to prevent those executions. And so this regulation is kind of a catch-all patch by the Justice Department to try to kind of smooth over a lot of those issues that were raised and some of those holes that the litigants tried to poke. So that to give the Justice Department more latitude, so that they can increase their chances of conducting several more executions before inauguration day.
Mm. You write that this may soon be legal in various states. Firing squads will soon be legal in states?
I believe there are three states that where firing squads are illegal. Form of administering death penalty.
Now, there are 16 altogether, 16 rules that have been finalized. We haven't even touched on the reviews for the final rules and then proposed rules. How are you all keeping track of all of this? Because there are just so many on this list.
Yeah, it's a huge task, and there are more that we're finding every day. And so we're talking to people who follow these policy areas closely and have their eye on, you know, the most important issues that they're seeing. And we're also keeping track of the White House Office of Management and Budget has a dashboard where they disclose the stages of the review for the rules that they're looking at. So we're keeping an eye on things as they move through there. And then we're keeping an eye on what gets formally published in what's called the Federal Register for either proposals or final rules to make sure we're not missing anything. But we want people's help if listeners know about rules that that aren't already on our list and that should be. We want to hear from them.
We mentioned a number of the finalized rules. What else really stands out for you?
Well, this isn't a rule exactly, but it's another example of an agency action that is clearly being rushed to try to happen before the inauguration, and that's the oil drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And they just yesterday started selling off leases, and they didn't even wait to finish the comment period for accepting public input on the bids that they were accepting. And that is clearly just because they're trying to finish it before January 20th. And, you know, that's a good example of one of these shortcuts where they're trying to do things faster, but it could create an opening for a court challenge. It's not necessarily that those are actually ever going to be holes in the ground.
Right. Well, and this one's been interesting just to watch over the last few years. We've had members of the Gwich'in Steering Committee on the show, and this is the unified voice of the Gwich'in Nation of Alaska and Canada, and they've been doing so much work to ensure that drilling does not happen. And over the last couple days, they've posted a number of articles about how every major bank has ruled out funding Arctic drilling, and now we're seeing that major insurance companies are saying that they don't want to be involved in this.
Yes, that's right. Again, there are a lot of steps. You know, even if the leases are sold, then there are permits that have to be issued and environmental reviews. So there are a lot of steps that would have to happen before anything actually happens on the ground, and it's pretty unlikely that that'll happen before January 20th. But it's kind of all the more, you know, why are they rushing to do what they can? And what you might end up happening is a lease that's sold, and then the Biden administration tries to get out of it and ends up needing to compensate the buyer.
Mm. Well, today we are speaking with Isaac Arnsdorf, a reporter at ProPublica, covering national politics. Isaac and his team have put together a very important list. They're tracking the Trump administration's, quote, midnight regulations. They're rushing to implement dozens of policy changes in its final days. And if you have any questions or comments for Isaac about this list and what the Biden administration can do to overturn these or make sure that they are not implemented, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk about some of the other reviews that really stand out. This is under White House Reviewing Final Rule, and there are 14 here. So let's talk about a couple of these that would affect people that are not getting much attention. Here's one in labor, allowing tip pooling with back-of-house restaurant workers. After Congress thwarted the department's initial attempt to allow employers to skim tips as long as workers were still making at least the minimum wage, the new rulemaking would only let servers pool tips with cooks and other non-tipped staff. Can you tell us how this will affect restaurant workers who are just really struggling right now to make ends meet, if they have a job at all?
Well, right, if they're working at all with so many closures in so many places. You know, this is a controversial one because it sort of pits workers in different parts of the restaurant against each other. And it's a good example. The Labor Department has been extremely aggressive with finalizing a lot of rules over the course of just a few months. So I could want to try to pull up when this one was proposed, but a lot of these are really just earlier. This one's a little bit older, but some of the other Labor Department rules that they've been pushing through only in a few months and are teed up now that they could be finalized any day.
Hmm. And then you also write about removing penalties for accidentally killing birds. We did a couple of shows about this. In 2017, the Fish and Wildlife Service issued a legal opinion interpreting the Migratory Bird Treaty Act to only forbid killing birds intentionally, not incidentally, in the course of things like oil drilling. So the birds basically land in these pits and can't get out. The agency was sued, and in 2020, a judge restored some protections for birds, but the Fish and Wildlife Service continued a rulemaking process to formalize the opinion. You all report that a final rule is coming in the coming months.
Yep, this is in the very last stage, and a lot of these White House reviews have been happening much faster than normal. And so this is definitely one that could be finalized before the inauguration. And it's a change from whether an accidental killing counts as a taking, like hunting, or whether it basically is a license to kill for industries that aren't doing it on purpose, but where it's common and expected that it's going to happen sometime. Mm.
We did a show earlier this week about the growing hunger crisis in this country. I mean, this one is especially cruel. The rule would remove 3 million individuals from food stamp rolls by changing eligibility so that recipients of other types of benefits do not automatically qualify. And advocacy groups say the change will put even more people at risk of hunger during COVID.
Absolutely. This is a very controversial one for the reasons that you just stated. And the administration has been pushing it just as hard, regardless of everything that's been going on with the increased demand for food banks because of the economic crisis from the pandemic.
You also have another one that's affecting food. This is a proposed rule. This would relax nutritional requirements for school lunches. After losing in court on a previous attempt, the Department of Agriculture is trying to relax nutritional requirements in school lunches, allowing more salt, white flour, and flavored milk. Even with an abbreviated comment period, the rule would be tough to finalize before January 20th. So we know where this one's coming from. Isaac, I mean, some of this stuff just kind of makes you just kind of shake your head and say, why? I mean, to allow more salt, flour, and flavored milk in kids' school lunches at a time when they need more healthy food.
Well, that is another example of an economic interest where there's pressure from commodity food producers who supply these lunches and want to be able to continue to do that or have more flexibility in doing that.
And then another one that clearly comes from industry, the billion-dollar slaughter industry. This one would increase the speed at which chickens may be slaughtered. Under this rule, chicken factories would be allowed to run faster, increasing potential profits, but putting workers at higher risk of injuries like amputations and carpal tunnel. This, as you report, this process actually takes about 2 years, so it's not clear if this rule can be finished before the inauguration.
No, but the fact that they are trying with this proposal has a lot of people concerned because there is a lot of evidence that running the plants faster does put workers at more risk of injury. And also, it's a little bit less well documented, but there's a lot of concern about the food safety as a result of that, so that it makes it harder for inspectors to catch contamination and germs like salmonella.
And the Trump administration has been trying to do this with other animals. I mean, there are so many others that we haven't had time to get to. I'm making families of non-citizen immigrants ineligible for subsidized housing, preventing the use of fetal tissue obtained from elective abortions to be used in federally funded research. There's so many here that would roll back environmental protections. Can you tell us just how you are all, because this is a massive undertaking, planning to track all of these in the coming weeks?
I mean, again, I'm lucky to have help from a number of colleagues, and We are in touch with people who are experts in different policy areas who are letting us know what they're seeing with the priorities that they're watching. And then we also are just looking at the what gets flagged at the Office of Management, the White House Office of Management and Budget, and at the Federal Register. So there, you know, there is a public-facing aspect of this, and it's, you know, it's not exactly written in plain English, so it can be a little bit hard to figure out what they're talking about, and that's part of the challenge for us is trying to translate basically the legal policy language into something understandable about what this actually does, and figure out if it's controversial and consequential.
Yeah, so consequential. I mean, this affects so many people's lives. Huge thanks to you, Isaac, and your team for putting this list together. And before the inauguration, we'd love to have you back to get updates, especially on the proposed rules and then the rules that are currently under review. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Isaac Arensdorf is a reporter at ProPublica, and I hope you can take some time to read this. It's just so important to get the word out about this. We have a link on our website. It's called Tracking the Trump Administration's Midnight Regulations. They are trying to implement as many policy changes as they can. And in some cases, the Biden administration can reverse these. In other cases, it might be pretty tough. So we're going to follow this, and we will bring you the latest in the weeks to come. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.